Arizona's basically been beat up the last FBI investigation. It's a double A, $100,000. Those kids could have just packed it and said, you know, we're out of here. That whole team is basically gone. They go and win the Pac-12 tournament, which says that winning's important to them. I think their goal is to say, you know, I don't care NCAA, I don't care FBI. We're going to go and win the NCAA tournament. We're going to hang a banner. If you want to take it down in a month or two, go do it.
Just wait until they try to pass this rule where kids can transfer just all willy-nilly. Oh, that's going to be the death of mid-major college basketball. Sure. Think about it for just a second. Let's say you've got a really good player at a mid-major, and it's August, and Kansas suffers an injury. And if they allow kids just to transfer whenever they want, that kid is, boom, he's going to bounce. I believe that mid-major college basketball, that's really the fabric of the NCAA tournament. Absolutely. I mean, because that's what makes it great, is because you have a 12 seed upset a 5 seed almost every year. And that 12 seed normally comes from a mid-major. There's great value in mid-major college basketball, but it seems like they want to tilt all the rules against those conferences.
I think it raises a very important point, and that is the discussion of the last 10, last 12 criteria was eliminated in 2008, 2009. It's really important to not misunderstand what the committee did at the time, which was they eliminated it not because they weren't going to consider it, but because the way in which they were looking at the team information had the full chronological schedule. So you could see the last 5, 10, 15 games in order. You could tell how it was. It didn't need to be an arbitrary 10 or 12 games. The fact that some of these decisions turned out the way they did, I think merits a discussion with the chair again. Is that literally no longer something that you're looking at? Because if that's the case, I think that's an issue.
Kirk Cousins had a visit set up with the Minnesota Vikings. That is expected to be tomorrow night. He's going to fly in. He's going to have dinner with coaches and other essential personnel, and then tour the brand new facility on Thursday. And this visit is important because he wants to make sure he has a good rapport with the coaches, has a good rapport with the personnel staff, and really everyone involved with the Vikings. There is an offer out to him. It's 3 years, $28 million per year. That is fully guaranteed, which is huge because there has never been, to my knowledge, a multi-year, fully guaranteed deal for a quarterback. $28 million per year, again, which would make him the highest paid quarterback in NFL history on a fully guaranteed year deal. Plan is for Kirk Cousins to sign this if all goes well with the visit. So, of course, as the Vikings zero in on Kirk Cousins, the other teams involved, the Arizona Cardinals, the New York Jets, they are simply left wondering where their quarterback is going to be and forced to move on to Plan B.
I think part of Case Keenum's thinking here is to get out in front of it. He knew that if he waited around, that in the game of musical chairs, the quarterback position, he might come up short. And I think that he felt his best move is to strike early. And so barring some last unforeseen setback in negotiations, Case Keenum does intend to sign with Denver.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to ye old extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Hope you're having a great Tuesday. And my, oh my, what the hell just happened? In all seriousness, I don't understand what happened. I'm struggling here. When Matthew Stafford of the Detroit Lions signed the richest contract in the history of the National Football League, I expressed my dismay. I said, a guy who has never won a playoff game can't be the highest paid player in the National Football League. I know he plays the most important position. I know he's put up some good statistics. I know that the franchise quarterback position is something that everybody's looking to fill, and if you have one, you take care of him and make sure he stays put. I get all of that, but I still had a problem with Matthew Stafford getting the most money ever to play professional football. I would negotiate Matthew Stafford's new contract myself to get him even more, if it meant justice when it comes to contracts, total value of salary in the National Football League, to give him more than Kirk Cousins. Kirk Cousins has done even less in the National Football League than Matthew Stafford has done. And now Kirk Cousins not only becomes the richest player on an average per season contract in the history of the league, he signs the largest contract in terms of guaranteed dollars in the history of the league, because every dollar of the contract is guaranteed for the first time for someone at his position in the history of the league. This is monumental, my friends. This is game-changing, earth-shattering, rim-rocking, whatever you want to call it. It is an absolute bombshell. We knew that Kirk Cousins was going to be the most sought-after free agent quarterback among veterans who did have a contract year coming. We knew that names like Keenum, and we heard some of that in the montage as well, would draw some interest. We know that there were a few other guys who are potentially able, now that, of course, Jimmy Garoppolo was taken off the market by the trade and then the subsequent massive contract. He had the new record, right, for what, a hot minute? He passed Matthew Stafford for like a hot minute with the highest contract ever until Kirk Cousins comes along, try saying that five times fast, and gets this three-year, $28 million per, that's $84 million total dollars, each and every one of them guaranteed contracts, from the Minnesota Vikings. And I'm looking at Matthew Stafford and saying, I'm sorry, bro, I was wrong. You probably should have gotten that, because now you are underpaid by comparison to Kirk Cousins. Somebody is going to have to explain this to me. How it is that Kirk Cousins can be valued so highly, given the fact that he has never won a playoff game, that in fact he has played, let's just say, less than stellar in given moments over the last couple of years in Washington, when he needed to step up and play exceptionally well to be a playoff quarterback. He has blown opportunities to do that. In his three seasons as a Washington Redskin full-time starter, 16 games played in 2015, 2016, and 2017. He has put up some very good numbers, no question about that. At no time have those numbers been threatening to push his team into contention to be a Super Bowl team, to be a playoff winning team. Kirk Cousins has played in two playoff games. The first one, he only played, well, very minimally. He was 3-for-10 in 31 yards in a meaningless game in 2012 for him. In 2015, he started and was 29-of-46 with 329 yards and a touchdown, 91 quarterback rating in a loss. And as I said, in 2016 and 17, when they needed him to be bigger and better to get back to the playoffs, he wasn't there. He didn't show. He didn't have the game he needed to have. He has not. Do I think Kirk Cousins is terrible? Of course not. But he's 29 years old. He has been only a full-time starter for 3 years. And in those 3 years, he has done nothing to earn the title of richest quarterback in the history of the sport. At least Matthew Stafford had a track record. At least Matthew Stafford, you know, when I say that, obviously he has never won a playoff game either. And that's one of the reasons why I was critical of the richest contract ever. But he has been doing it for a long time. Matthew Stafford has a track record of being a prolific quarterback. He has a 5,000 passing yard season under his belt with 41 touchdowns back in 2011. And then barely missing a 5,000 yarder again in 2012 with 4,900 yards. And then he has, 4,000 plus every single season ever since. I mean, when you've been in this thing as long as Stafford has, and you've been putting up the numbers Stafford has put up, you can argue that, well, he might not have won a playoff game, but the consistent production is there that if you put enough pieces around him, he will. I don't know that I can say that with Kirk Cousins, because it's only been three seasons. He's 29. He's 1 year younger than Matthew Stafford. Matthew Stafford is 30. Kirk Cousins is 29, and as I mentioned, Kirk Cousins has 3 years of starting under his belt. Matthew, with 4,000 yards plus in each of those. Matthew Stafford has been doing this for, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seasons. And if The Lions would ever have seen fit to give him a running game to go along with what he can do. There is no telling whether or not he could have ever earned that greatest contract in the history of the sport. But I'll say this about Kirk Cousins and about the Minnesota Vikings. This is a game changer. It's a deal breaker. It's a monumental tectonic plate shifting beneath the surface of the National Football League type of contract. What have NFL players been begging for forever in their collective bargaining agreements? What have they been negotiating for? What has been their biggest complaint when comparing themselves to their counterparts in the other massive professional sports in the North American landscape? When they compare themselves to the Major League Baseball players, when they compare themselves to NBA players, what is the one thing they have always sought? And they have expressed a lot of chagrin, a lot of disagreement with their Players Association representatives, with the head of the Players Association, Demora Smith, for not being able to work. They want to have the same thing that the basketball and the football guys have. And I'm not sure about hockey, Kushlin. You might know more than I do if they have these. But they wanted guaranteed contracts. They want the same thing that baseball. Baseball, you sign a 7-year, $120 million contract, you're getting $120 million, even if you break both arms and legs in year one. If you never play again, you're getting $120 million. Or if you do play, but you bat .217 for the next 7 years with 6 home runs and 19 RBIs, you're still getting $120 million.
And, yes, I'm looking up Justin Ablicator's current contract with the Red Wings. I'm seeing nothing about guaranteed versus not guaranteed. So it's guaranteed.
It is guaranteed. Okay. In the NBA, if you sign a 4-year contract, well, what did Timofey Mozgov sign for, $64 million?
He was something ridiculous, yes.
Is he still in the league? Is Mozgov, once the Lakers dumped him, is he still playing someplace? I don't even know if Timofey Mozgov is still in the league. But I can guarantee you this, whether he is or he isn't, whether he's in the league right now or whether he's back home in Russia.
He's with Brooklyn. 14 starts with the Nets this year.
Okay, thank you. I was going to say.
I was curious about that, too, because I haven't seen him.
Whether he's in the league or whether
him.
He's back in Moscow eating pierogies and shoveling snow. He's making every penny of the $64 million that he signed with the Lakers for 4 years, year before last. So he's got that money coming over the next two. NFL players have been begging for it. We don't have guaranteed contracts. People get mad at us and say, he signed a 5-year, $80 million contract. That's $16 million a year. That's way too much for him. And they're quick to point out rightly, correctly, the agents are quick to point out, the NFLPA quick to point out, yeah, but only, $17 million of that is guaranteed. Only $17 million, I'm making up a deal here, only $17 million in the signing bonus and in the first-year salary is guaranteed. After that, if he gets cut, he doesn't make a penny more of that quote-unquote $80 million contract. It's like a thing that doesn't exist. It's money in theory that you're going to get paid, but certain circumstances have to be met for you to get paid, to get those dollars. Not being cut. Not being injured. Well, this is a game changer. Kirk Cousins just got a $84 million guaranteed 3-year contract. And that's going to change everything for every free agent going forward. I mean, think about that. If you thought the Pittsburgh Steelers had hell on their hands with Le'Veon Bell, the best running back in football, who had 400 and some odd touches last year, you talk about a workhorse. If you thought the Steelers were going to have a hard time re-signing him, and obviously they are because he did not want to be franchised again, he wanted to be paid commensurate with what his value is in terms of being the best running back in football. He had 300 and like 10 plus carries. And he had 85 receptions. Like I said, he had like 410, 420 some odd touches last year. Just a spectacular offensive weapon. And he wants to be paid like a spectacular offensive weapon. And the Steelers are like, look, if we give you a long-term massive contract, it's going to kill our ability to sign some of the other people that we need to keep on this team and add to this team to get over the hump and to get past the Patriots and get back to Super Bowl. Le'Veon, help us out a little bit. Le'Veon says no. And if you franchise me, well, I'm not coming to an OTA. I'm not coming to a voluntary camp of any kind. I'm not coming to training camp. I'll see you on game day, game one. That's all I'll do for my
almost like he did last
contract.
Year.
That's very close to that, yes, sir. And by the way, you remember he started slowly because of that.
Indeed.
Well, that was before Kirk Cousins just got guaranteed dollars. What do you think is going to happen with Le'Veon? By the way, Le'Veon Bell is taking some. Oh, my, is he taking some from, talk about friendly fire, from within Steeler Nation. They are letting him have it, talking about how this is just abject greed. The contract he's going to get in terms of the franchise tag is going to pay him somewhere in the neighborhood of $14, $15 million this year. He made about that much last year. That is not like, it's not like he's being asked to work for minimum wage. When you are franchised, you are given the average of the top five contracts at your position on an annual basis. And that's going to pay him a whole hell of a lot of money to be a running back that, quite frankly, and I'm getting a little bit off on a tangent here and away from the Cousins thing, and I'm going to get to Case Keenum in a moment too, but a little bit, you know, lost in all of this is the importance of the running back. While certainly I pointed out, you know, the Lions struggles in this Matthew Stafford era in terms of, you know, taking one of the more polished, productive and efficient quarterbacks going in terms of franchise quarterbacks and adding a running game that he can use to offset, you know, defenses to create balance to get this team not only into the playoffs but winning a game or two and pushing up toward a Super Bowl, which is the goal. While I certainly say you need to have a running game, you don't necessarily need to have a Cadillac running back. You don't need to have the ultimate driving machine, right? I mean, let's look at it this way. I would add, and I don't have the list of Super Bowl winners in front of me, but how many times, and let's just say in the last 20 years to make it easier, or even 30, I don't know, how many times has the running back led his team to a Super Bowl championship? I want you to think about that. When is the last time that a running back led his team to a Super Bowl championship?
Honestly, the first one, that just to answer that question real quick, to maybe put what you're trying to get at in perspective, the first one, as I'm trying to think back, that popped in my head, would have been Elway's first Super Bowl, Denver over Green Bay, because Terrell Davis was a beast in that game. And it always gets overshadowed by the helicopter Elway spin play. But Terrell Davis blatantly, well, I think, was the difference for
understand,
Denver.
Understand
that was
what I mean, though. No, understand what I mean when I say led a team to a Super Bowl championship. I don't mean had a big game in the Super Bowl. I mean was the driving force that got you to a Super Bowl. Was the star player on your offense that took you to a Super Bowl and won you a title. See what I'm asking?
We're still in when the same ballpark of, then. Terrell
you,
Davis was
you couldn't
for
even
that whole
say
season.
That about, you couldn't even say that about Emmitt Smith, the all-time leading rusher.
No, in a way you can't.
You couldn't even say that about Walter Payton when they won in 85 because it was the defense that led that title. You couldn't
Payton
say
didn't
that,
even actually have a statistically good game in that Super Bowl either.
Say again?
Payton didn't even really have that good of a statistical game in that Super Bowl either.
Well, again, you're focusing on the game. I'm talking about the leading cog in an offense that wins a Super Bowl, not has a big game in the Super Bowl. I'm talking about as the driving force. The Bears' defense was the driving force that took them to that record and took them to the Super Bowl and won it. The Ravens' defense carried them when Trent Dilfer won his. It wasn't Jamal Lewis. It was the defense. Almost invariably, if you look back throughout history, it's almost impossible to find a time where a team was led through a regular season and the playoffs and into a Super Bowl championship by the running back and not by either the quarterback or the defense. The one that I might go to, and it goes back further than the 20 or 30 years that I just said, would be going back to the Miami Dolphins in 72 when they had their perfect season, because Bob Greasy was a good quarterback, a competent quarterback. Their defense was a good defense, but it might have been the three-headed monster of Zonka and Mercury Morris, Larry Zonka, Mercury Morris, and who was the third one of the three running backs? They had a three-headed monster there, but it was mostly Zonka. You could argue that running team for most of 1972, That led their offense more than the passing game did. And I don't know why I'm flaking on the 72 Dolphins running backs. It's making me feel stupid. But at any rate, and think about it, how many Super Bowls have there been? What did we just play? Number 52?
Yeah. Was it 53? No, 52. You're right. 52. It was 52.
Right? Yeah, it was 1952. It was 52 Super Bowls. And I've just picked one that I think I might be able to say led them the entire way. And the reason I'm omitting your Terrell Davis example is again, because it was still John Elway. And Elway's leadership and passing game, complemented by Davis, that got them to the Super Bowl. And then, yes, of course, Terrell Davis had a monster Super Bowl. But the driving force. So my point to all of this is going back to the Le'Veon Bell thing. Le'Veon Bell is a great player. He might be the Cadillac of running backs, but you don't need a Cadillac running back to win a Super Bowl. You need either a superstar quarterback or you need a competent quarterback and a great defense in order to win a Super Bowl. I mean, look at the quarterbacks, running backs that you know, the greatest ones that come up. Obviously, Barry Sanders never got it going because of the circumstances in Detroit. Emmitt Smith, of course, had the great passing game and a really great defense, too. He had a little bit of everything. If you look at, trying to think who the other, Earl Campbells of the world and the Adrian Petersons of the world, no Super Bowls. The best running backs ever. They don't lead teams to Super Bowls. They're big pieces. They're complementary pieces to quarterbacks that lead to Super Bowls. And now Le'Veon Bell, because of Kirk Cousins, is probably going to go to the Steelers and to anybody who is going to look at him in free agency after the upcoming 2018-19 season. And he's going to say, I want guaranteed money. And guess what? Whoever the number one pick in the draft is going to, his agent is going to say, Kirk Cousins signed 3 years, $84 million. All of it guaranteed. We want a guaranteed contract. We want 4 years or whatever the rookie deal is going to be, and we want it all guaranteed. This could be just an absolute life changer for NFL players. And the fact that the Vikings were, by the way, and this is the other part of this, and I know I'm getting a little bit off ahead of myself here because we got to talk college basketball in a moment. But the other big news in free agency, which, of course, doesn't even start until tomorrow. What time? When our show starts, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I think right when we start, it opens up officially, yeah.
Well, that's when the league year starts, and that's when free agency can happen. But all of these agreements are being made ahead of time in what's called the tampering period, or is referred to as the tampering period. We all know that Case Keenum, who is now the outgoing Minnesota Vikings NFC Championship game leading quarterback of the Vikings, is now going to take over in Denver. And I'm thinking to myself, he's going to get paid probably $10 to $12 million a year less than Kirk Cousins is to take his job. And if you look at them side by side last year, Case Keenum was the better quarterback. Case Keenum last year was second in the NFL in terms of completion percentage. He had a higher completion percentage. He had virtually every statistic, measurable statistic, next to Kirk Cousins. Case Keenum was better. But Cousins is the one who's going to get the $84 million guaranteed contract from Minnesota, and Minnesota lets Case Keenum go to Denver, where he will, I think, be terrific. I think Case Keenum is a great story, a little bit of a late, you know, a bloomer, if you will, in terms of his NFL career. Did not exactly light it on fire when he was in Houston. Excuse me, but... is a guy that is very, 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 very good. Excuse me again. Who is being devalued by his existing team so that they can overpay Kirk Cousins, a man who has never won a playoff game. Case Keenum just led his team, the Vikings, to the NFC Championship game. He is a playoff winner. He made huge throws in the playoff wins. Kirk Cousins has never done it. And he's got $84 million guaranteed dollars. It's really an amazing thing. All right, we have a lot more to talk about in that regard. I really want to get back into the NFL free agency and some of the numbers and some of the names, talk about how all of this movement is going to impact the draft, and it will. But we'll have to wait until the 4 o'clock hour for that, because coming up after the bottom of the hour local sports center, we're going to talk a little bit more about the NCAA, not necessarily the tournament per se coming up next, as obviously we have the play-in games tomorrow, and then we've got the first round. And
actually, those play-in games start tonight.
Oh, that's right. They're tonight, aren't they?
Tonight, two tonight. One is tonight. Two tonight, two tomorrow.
Two are tonight. Okay, thank you. So there's two and two. Thank you, Jim. Yeah, that makes sense, of course, because the two that play tonight will play Thursday. The two that play tomorrow will play Friday.
I mean, it's precisely, the winners, exactly.
The winners
will.
Right,
yep.
Thank you. Anyway, as the tournament gets started is what I'm trying to say. Certainly we're going to talk about those matchups and all of the rest. But coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk to Brian Lutz. He is the Associate Athletic Director for Compliance with the University of Toledo. You may recall a conversation if you listen to the show with regularity, and if you do, thank you. We appreciate it. And you may have heard it in the montage that Kush played at the top of the hour, too. Seth Greenberg, Jeff Dickerson, and Greg Shaheen all talking about transfer rules. Some coaches are calling, or excuse me, some advocates for the players are calling for the players to be able to transfer just as freely and easily as the coaches do if they want to go from one school to the next. What would the impact be? So we're going to talk about what the current transfer rules are and what some of those proposals are. How would that impact the big schools, and how would that impact schools in the MAC like Toledo? So Brian Lutz, the Associate AD for Compliance, knows the answer to all of those questions at the University of Toledo, and he will join us coming up after the bottom of the hour Sports Center, which comes after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings, Wild Stat of the Day. Though in reality, the tournament does start Thursday afternoon. They will tell you technically it starts tonight with what they call the first four. I do not like it. It is a play-in game. You are not part of the tournament. Any one of these eight teams, I'm sorry you're not. This is the eighth season of play of this play-in round, and there is something that should be noted about it. Every year since its inception, at least one first four-game winner has advanced to the second round. Two have made it all the way to the Sweet 16. LaSalle did it in 2013, Tennessee in 2014, while one, VCU in 2011, made it to the Final Four. So that is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day, and we're going to talk more college basketball transfer-wise coming up next right here on The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Just wait until they try to pass this rule where kids can transfer just all willy-nilly. Oh, that's going to be the death of mid-major college basketball. Sure. Think about it for just a second. Let's say you got a really good player at a mid-major, and it's August, and Kansas suffers an injury. And if they allow kids just to transfer whenever they want, that kid is, boom, he's going to bounce. I believe that mid-major college basketball, that's really the fabric of the NCAA tournament. Absolutely. I mean, because that's what makes it great, is because you have a 12 seed upset a 5 seed almost every year. And that 12 seed normally comes from a mid-major. There's great value in mid-major college basketball, but it seems like they want to tilt all the rules against those conferences.
Yeah, they really do. That is a great point made about the transfer room. We talked about this last week. Again, I think it was Tubby Smith, who, according to
virtually all reports,
is going to be on his way out as the coach at Memphis, ending his legendary career, former national champion coach, obviously, at Kentucky. But anyway, Tubby Smith said he doesn't want players to be able to transfer at their whim because it teaches them how to quit. Because if they're in a tough situation, they're in a battle for a starting spot, or they're not getting enough touches, they're not getting enough shots, they don't think the coach is using them right in the rotation or whatever, they quit and go find something else. And that's not a good lesson to teach kids who are, for the most part, the vast majority. We've talked about this, 97, 98% of them are not going to the NBA. Only the very tiny few go to the NBA. That's a bad lesson to teach them. So we were talking about the transfer rules and exactly what they are and what some of the proposals are. We thought we'd bring in an expert to discuss this with us, and Brian Lutz is that expert. Brian is the Associate AD for Compliance at the University of Toledo. He joins us now on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Brian, thanks for the time. How are you?
No problem at all, Bob. I'm happy to be with you today.
Well, it's good to have you. We're going to talk to Coach Kowalczyk, by the way, in about an hour, so we're kind of UT-centric and UT-heavy today, and I wish we were talking about their first-round matchup in the NCAAs, but we'll put a wrap on what was a very good season for the Rockets. But for you, Brian, we want to kind of talk, and maybe just start out with your reaction to the commentary you just heard there. Jim, who was that who made that with those comments? Was that?
I believe that was Jeff Dickerson for one of the ESPN guys.
Okay, thank you. So you just heard the comments there on the way in, Brian Lutz, about the transfer rules and how they could negatively impact potentially mid-major schools like Toledo. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, you know, I think these transfer rules, you can look at it from a couple of different perspectives. I think you could see potentially situations where student athletes at schools such as ours or on the mid-major level, generally speaking, would be able to transfer up to some of the bigger schools. But I also think we may have access at our school to maybe some young men and ladies on the women's side in basketball that would be transferring down from major institutions to schools such as ours. So there's an NCAA committee right now that's looking at a lot of these things, and they have some concepts they're working on, and I think this spring they're gonna have some more details on what would appear to be not necessarily a free transfer for student athletes, but there's gonna be some academic requirements that student athletes are gonna have to meet in order to be able to transfer and be eligible right away. So the free agency hysteria, I think, that's being created right now isn't necessarily the way this is all gonna play out as time goes on.
Let's go back a half step here and talk about sure. The current rules. Under what circumstances can a college basketball, and again, I don't know if this is going to be universal for all sports or just if this is basketball-centric. Maybe you can tell us that. I was going to say sure. For college football as well. Under what circumstances can a student-athlete transfer now?
Transfer and be eligible right away
yes.
to play? Really, for the most part, a student-athlete who's graduated and has a year of eligibility remaining and go on and play immediately at their next school.
Okay, like we've seen a couple of times with University of Michigan, Jake Rudock, who's now a backup quarterback with the Lions, did that. He graduated from Iowa, then transferred to Michigan, was able to play right away because he was a graduate transfer. So that's one circumstance.
Exactly.
But what about underclassmen?
Underclassmen, for the most part, they have to sit a year upon transfer. You know, just a few years ago, there were situations, maybe a family situation that necessitated a student-athlete returning closer to home. There might be a financial hardship in a family that would allow, you know, a university to file a waiver on behalf of that student. But for the most part, Division I football, basketball, baseball even, and hockey, student-athletes who are undergraduates have to sit out a year upon transfer to another Division I school.
Okay, so they have to sit out. Now there have been some proposals and suggestions and ideas floated around saying, you know, if your coach is going to bail on you after recruiting you, and you know, you're in his plans, and let's say, you know, you're in his rotation, you're going to be one of a 7 or an 8-man rotation, even as a freshman or a sophomore, and you really like the idea of playing for this coach and studying at the school, and then he takes a job somewhere else. Well, the kid in that circumstance ought to be able to get up and go as well, because now he's going to be playing for somebody who might not think as highly of him. He should have an opportunity to do that. Is that something that is being considered among the many proposals right now?
It is, as a matter of fact. A student-athlete who may have been recruited by one coach leaves for perhaps greener pastures. Potentially, the student-athlete who was recruited by that coach could be able to leave and be eligible right away. So that's another concept that's being discussed. You know, the general public feeling is, you know, coaches have the freedom to leave and go wherever they want. Shouldn't the student athletes be able to do the same thing? And so in those circumstances, that may be possible as we look forward.
I think there's some fairness to that. I do, although, you know, these kids are student athletes. Their commitment to their university is supposed to be more than just what a coach's commitment is, which is an employer situation. They are not employees of the university. They are students of the university, and as such are held to a different kind of a standard than a coach who is simply, you know, breaking a contract with one employer to sign a contract with another employer. So from a fairness standpoint, Brian, how do you see it? Is it, should a kid be allowed to do that because a coach moves jobs? Should a student be able to say, well, then I'm changing my student status as well, and should we treat them like employees? And if we do, does that not open the door to paying them like they were actual employees, Brian?
Well, what I would say, Bob, and again, I'm speaking for myself. I'm not
Understood. Speaking
in this situation for the University of Toledo or anyone else. But
no, I guess
my general feel.
It's an opinion question offered to you, or, you know, or we're asking for your opinion. Yeah, it's not just official
exactly.
University
exactly.
policy or anything. I got you.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the NCAA rules revolve around student athletes, you know, being compared to the general student body and having the same freedoms that the general student body might have and being treated the same way as any other student at the university would be treated. And so in those circumstances, if a student can transfer freely from one school to another, and we see that more and more these days, and even looking at basketball right now, I think the last study that was done on transfers is roughly 40% of Division I basketball players end up transferring before – you know, their eligibility has expired. I mean, I personally feel like student athletes should be free to transfer as they wish, just the same as any other student at the university.
We're talking with Brian Lutz, who is the associate AD for compliance with the University of Toledo, about transfer rules. So you kind of called it free agency when you talked about freedom to transfer, no matter what the circumstances are. And you're saying people are a little overreacting to that. We're not there yet. Is that a direction that we will be? And if so, how long? Are we talking a year? Are we talking 2 or 3 years away? Or is it an incremental thing where we green light the transfer after a coach leaves, as you just described, on our way to just saying, you know what, you can leave anytime you want?
Yeah, you know, I think you're going to see probably in the next maybe year to 2 years where it's not going to be total free agency. Again, there's going to be an academic requirement that goes along with a student being immediately eligible. It could be based upon a certain GPA. That, you know, that's all being discussed currently. So whether it's a 3.0 GPA, it could be higher than that, could be a little bit lower. Just, it all depends right now, but there's going to be an academic requirement also that needs to be met in order for a student athlete to be immediately eligible. So as we look down the road, it's just not going to be entirely free agency. The students who have succeeded academically and are in a good place, are in a position to graduate, you're going to see those as the student athletes that are going to be immediately eligible to compete at their next school.
Brian Lutz is our guest. He is the associate AD, that would be for compliance with the University of Toledo. Do you believe that the negative impact that we just, and I'm kind of going back to the first question we asked you, is you kind of told everybody, cool your jets a little bit. We're not there. But if we get there, will it have that deleterious impact on smaller schools? If it's almost, because, you know, the way that Jeff Dickerson described that, I don't know about you, but to me it sounded like Major League Baseball. You know, hey, the parent club got an injury. We're going down to Toledo and grabbing a Mud Hen and bringing him up to Comerica Park to play for the Tigers now. And the Mud Hens are like, yeah, but he was our starting pitcher for tomorrow in a big game. And you just got a deal. Will mid-major schools be treated like that? Will they almost be seen as potential farm clubs for the bigger schools from the power conferences to mine for talent whenever they have a need?
I think to some extent it's already being done. You know, student athletes, mid-major, maybe kind of a late emerging athlete, under-recruited, ends up at a mid-major school, you know, goes to that mid-major school, successful, you know, appears to be someone who the larger conferences have an interest in. They're already, you know, being, I wouldn't say recruited necessarily because they can't be recruited, but I think through certain back channels, you know, those communications are being relayed back to that mid-major student athlete. And, you know, it's leading to them transferring to a bigger school, even though they have to sit out a year. So I think it's already happening. You're just not seeing the immediate eligibility of those student athletes. So they're transferring up, but they're having to sit a year before they can play.
Brian Lutz from the University of Toledo with us. Jim Cushlin here as well, as always. Jim, go ahead.
You know, thinking about all these aspects, Brian, and also harkening back to that that clip we played when we brought you in, I do wonder, and someone like you might be in a position to answer that, should they take away the current requirements for transferring, like some want to do, that has been brought up? Would that have the doomsday effect on the quote-unquote mid-majors schools like Toledo? Would that, on basketball and football, of course, specifically, would it have that doomsday effect of even making it worse in terms of the disparity, do you think? Or is there something we're missing in
that? You know, it's hard to say. It is possible, I would guess, depending upon what the standards are that are established, that you could see an adverse effect on, you know, successful mid-major programs in larger schools, kind of picking the more elite players from those schools, if there isn't some type of precautions that are taken, you know, through the legislation to prevent that from happening, whether it's a certain academic requirement or if there are other standards that are established to prevent that from happening. I guess we won't really know truly until, you know, the transfer rules change and there are some student athletes that could become immediately eligible. You know, I'm not quite sure how that's all going to play out just yet. I know a lot of coaches are really concerned about it, though. You know, it's one thing the NCAA is really considering with what's called the transfer working group. That's kind of the committee that's been established to look at these issues and trying to establish a rule that's fair both for the university and also for the student. So it's hard to look into the crystal ball and see how that's all going to look in a year or two. I'm not sure that it's going to be quite as bad as what some may think, especially if there's an academic requirement in place, whatever it is. But really, based upon my experience, I just some of these things that you think may end up, you know, turning the world of college athletics on its ear may not actually happen. It's one of these things where we're going to have to take a wait and see approach.
Last thing, Brian, before you go, and we certainly appreciate your time, who's going to make these final decisions? Will it be a committee of college presidents? Will it be the conference commissioners, some combination? I mean, I'm just trying to decide who will make any changes to the transfer rules if we do have wholesale changes.
Yeah, the group that's working on it right now, it's a combination of student-athletes, commissioners, compliance people such as myself, individuals throughout college athletics. I think even coaches are involved in these discussions within this committee. And so what they'll do, they'll make some recommendations to the NCAA, and the NCAA will formulate some rules, some proposals that will be up for consideration. And then, you know, based upon those proposals and whether or not, you know, it's thought that this is a good thing for college athletics, at that point, those rules are going to be established, and we're all going to pretty much have to live with them at that point until someone else decides they want to change them. So, you know, these rules, they're constantly changing, and so we'll just have to see, I guess, you know, what comes from this working group and then adjust to those changes, you know, as circumstances dictate.
Brian Lutz with some great information for us and a little look at the future potentially of transfer rules in college basketball. And, you know, I kind of just alluded to this at the beginning, Brian. Will it be similar for football, or are they going to have their own set of rules?
It'll be the same for football. Yeah, the rules will actually encompass all sports that are sponsored by the NCAA. So the major sports that, you know, commonly are talked about, but also what we call the Olympic sports in my business, they'll also be impacted by these changes as well.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Hey, Brian, really great information. Thanks for sharing it with us. Brian Lutz, Associate Athletic Director for Compliance with the University of Toledo. We appreciate it, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
No problem, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate the knowledge. Really good stuff there. So, you know, it's fun. It's funny, Jim Cushlin, he called it, you know, like free agency is what has people freaked out. But it essentially would be. And he said it's already going on. It's just that, you know, the kids are willing to sit a year. If you erase that, you know, that barrier, it's going to proliferate, by a factor of hundreds. I mean, honestly, excuse me, there's going to be no hesitance, no deterrent whatsoever for a kid who just decides, you know what, my coach isn't playing me enough, he's not getting me enough shots, this is hurting my draft stock, whatever the case might be. I broke up with my girlfriend, and I don't want to be on the same campus with her.
Jeff Dickerson in the opening montage clip made a perfect example. You know, Kansas suffers a big injury to a key player in August, so the phones start ringing.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But like I said, it doesn't even have to be that, you know, the big schools mining the smaller schools for talent example that I gave, like Major League Baseball, but just a kid isn't happy. Like I said, he has a personal problem on campus. He doesn't like a professor. His girlfriend breaks up with him. He doesn't want to see her every day. I'm going to go to another school. It just creates chaos, I think. You know, and talk about enticements, too. You know, we always have to worry, and we know about the FBI investigation that has been announced into several schools for various infractions or potential infractions, et cetera, the worst of which is Arizona, in which there are allegations of wiretaps that have the head coach there talking about $100,000 for his star freshman player. But, you know, we see this and we worry about this at recruiting time. If we allow pretty much unchecked transfers and essential student-athlete free agency, I think it would be impossible to track all of the little palms being greased, arms being twisted, promises being made to pull one kid from one school. I mean, what would stop And I'm just going to pick two names here because they're two of the biggest names for the biggest rivalry, arguably, in college basketball. This is not an implication of either of them that they would do this. This is strictly for the sake of an example. But what would stop Roy Williams from contacting the eighth guy in Mike Krzyzewski's rotation, a guy who's not getting much time, and saying, you know what, get your butt over here to Carolina, you'll be in my starting five. And a guy just walks from one to the other without any time sitting out whatsoever. And Krzyzewski says, oh, yeah, and you know, tells a North Carolina guy, we value you more than Williams does. Get over here. You know, we wanted you when you were coming out of high school anyway, but now, as you can see, it's not working out there in Carolina. You're averaging 7 points a game for them. You could average double digits here tomorrow. And again, that's just an example, not picking on those guys. That's the kind of stuff that could happen. And obviously, with smaller schools and with, you know, lesser known schools than the two big names that I just said, pretty much without media notice, pretty much without any scrutiny whatsoever,
yeah,
all kinds of promises and you know, things that you can't guarantee kids would be offered. And it would create chaos. I don't like
that. No, and you're right. You're right about the chaos and how it would be so hard to figure out who's, you know, greasing whose wheels. And, you know, to me, when you were saying that, you know what popped into my head? Because I happened to watch it, catch it on a rerun in the last week and a half or so. The ESPN 30 for 30 on SMU, the Pony Access, where obviously these exact kind of things came into play. And I'm like, oh, goodness, we're going to have to keep track of it like that tenfold? Because that's what it is. That's why, as for me, Bob, as this whole transfer rules talk has been trying to heat up in light of all these things, that's why the only change I want to see them do, and I know some are working on this, is you keep it the way it is, unless you play for a coach who just bolted on you at the end, you know, one of those things. That's
the only scenario.
Otherwise,
and
there shouldn't
then,
be any reason to change this. You made the commitment.
And even then, there might have to be limitations to that,
sure,
Jim,
sure,
such as a person in their freshman or sophomore years. Like, if you've already been there for 3 years, you are what you are in that program. And if you're a junior or a senior and your coach leaves, you don't get to bolt now. But if you were just recruited as a freshman and now your guy leaves, you ought to be able to decommit and go someplace else. And even if you're a sophomore, and because maybe you redshirted your freshman year, and now you're expecting to play for this guy and then he bails on you, you ought to be able to have a chance. But once you're a junior or better, then I think probably.
And I hope that's what they work on, because to me, we shouldn't forget that the whole concept, especially from a player's perspective of changing these rules, really kind of stems from that example of the coach leaving and I'm stuck here thing.
Right,
that's where all this started.
Yeah, no question
address
about
that.
All right, let's get out here because we're a little late. It's 4:02. We'll get a top of the hour local sports center. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about the NFL free agency period, which starts tomorrow. I've got some thoughts on what the Lions can and might do. I've got some thoughts on what the Browns can and already have done. And obviously, these quarterbacks, what a game changer for Kirk Cousins. What a game changer for the NFL if he has now set the benchmark for guaranteed money and guaranteed years, something that NFL players have been craving forever. Finally coming to pass because of Kirk Cousins. We'll get into that as we continue coming up next hour on ESPN.
Arizona's basically been beat up the last FBI investigation, NCAA, $100,000. Those kids could have just packed it and said, you know, we're out of here. That whole team is basically gone. They go and win the Pac-12 tournament, which says winning's important to them. I think their goal is to say, you know, I don't care NCAA, I don't care FBI. We're going to go and win the NCAA tournament. We're going to hang a banner. If you want to take it down in a month or two, go do it.
Just wait until they try to pass this rule where kids can transfer just all willy-nilly. Oh, that's going to be the death of mid-major college basketball.
Sure.
Think about it for just a second. Let's say you've got a really good player at a mid-major, and it's August, and Kansas suffers an injury. And if they allow kids just to transfer whenever they want, that kid is, boom, he's going to bounce. I believe that mid-major college basketball, that's really the fabric of the NCAA tournament.
Absolutely.
I mean, because that's what makes it great, is because you have a 12 seed upset a 5 seed almost every year. And that 12 seed normally comes from a mid-major. There's great value in mid-major college basketball, but it seems like they want to tilt all the rules against those conferences.
I think it raises a very important point, and that is the discussion of the last 10, last 12 criteria was eliminated in 2008, 2009. It's really important to not misunderstand what the committee did at the time which was they eliminated it not because they weren't going to consider it, but because the way in which they were looking at the team information had the full chronological schedule. So you could see the last 5, 10, 15 games in order. You could tell how it was. It didn't need to be an arbitrary 10 or 12 games. The fact that some of these decisions turned out the way they did, I think merits a discussion with the chair again. Is that literally no longer something that you're looking at? Because if that's the case, I think that's an issue.
Cousins had a visit set up with the Minnesota Vikings. That is expected to be tomorrow night. He's going to fly in. He's going to have dinner with coaches and other essential personnel, then tour the brand new facility on Thursday. And this visit is important because he wants to make sure he has a good rapport with the coaches, has a good rapport with the personnel staff, and really everyone involved with the Vikings. There is an offer out to him. It's 3 years, $28 million per year. That is fully guaranteed, which is huge because there has never been, to my knowledge, a multi-year, fully guaranteed deal for a quarterback. $28 million per year, again, which would make him the highest paid quarterback in NFL history on a fully guaranteed year deal. Plan is for Kirk Cousins to sign this if all goes well with the visit. So, of course, as the Vikings zero in on Kirk Cousins, the other teams involved, the Arizona Cardinals, the New York Jets, they are simply left wondering where their quarterback is going to be and forced to move on to Plan B.
I think part of Case Keenum's thinking here is to get out in front of it. He knew that if he waited around, that in the game of musical chairs, the quarterback position, he might come up short. And I think that he felt his best move is to strike early. And so barring some last unforeseen setback in negotiations, Case Keenum does intend to sign with Denver.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed, rolling along. Are we 16 minutes after 4 o'clock right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket? Question for you. Need a new roof? $1 down. Need new siding? $1 down. New windows? $1 down. Get a new look your choice. Roof, siding, or windows for $1 down. That is the power, my friends, of 7 years interest-free. And that's what you get when you don't delay. You call WeatherSeal today. WeatherSeal today, make that. Get the roof, siding, or windows you've always wanted for only $1 down at 877-WINDOWS. Call WeatherSeal today at 877-WINDOWS. Roof, siding, and windows the way you've always wanted. WeatherSealHomeServices.com. I still don't understand how 3 years and $84 million happens, fully guaranteed, for a guy who's never won a playoff game. Somebody explain this to me. Now, here's the thing. I'm going back to the NFL free agency period now because we talked about this at the top of the show, and then we started talking a little college basketball transfer rules. And we got more college basketball coming up as we do kind of a Rockets season wrap or recap, if you will, with Coach Todd Kowalczyk coming up from UT at about 4:40. So in between now and then, if you want to be heard on this, I would like to hear from you. There's another big quarterback deal that went down today, Kush. If you did not hear, one of the greatest quarterbacks in the history of the game, arguably the most prolific statistical passing quarterback in the history of the game, Drew Brees, signed a new contract. Drew Brees, did you know this, Jim, that in the history of the National Football League, only 9 times has a quarterback thrown for 5,000 or more yards in a single season?
They've all happened relatively recently, too, haven't they?
How many years has the league been in existence?
It depends.
Need an exact number, but I mean, just, you know, I mean, it's you know, many,
considering
many
how football was played back in the 40s. I'll just start with the merger of 1970.
Well, I would go back, no, because now you're eliminating, you know, the Browns championships in the 60s and 50s and the Lions championship days in the early parts of the league. I'll go back to the 40s.
True, but I'm suspecting 5,000-yard passers, sure there were none before 1970.
You're right, there were none before 1980 either. The first one was 1984 with Dan Marino.
That's right.
So, you know, I mean, that everybody knows that. But my point is, the league has been around since, let's just say, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now the 2010s. And only 9 years in, you know, 90 years, you know, because I'm not doing the math.
Give or take, yeah.
9 times has a quarterback done this, starting with Marino, who did it in 1984. And did you know Jim Cushlin, and very few people do, 5 of those 9 were Drew Brees.
I did not know.
Nobody knows this. Nobody talks about that. 5 of the 9 times it was done by Drew Brees. when we think of the greatest statistical passing quarterbacks of all time, forever, it was Dan Marino.
Right.
And then it became, to a degree, because of longevity, Brett Favre. Then it became Peyton Manning. And now Tom Brady is still going and is going to do all kinds of crazy things. But in the midst of all of it, the guy who is going to end up with the most touchdown passes and the most passing yards and all the rest very well could be and should be Drew Brees. Five. Jim, he's thrown for at least. You know, I was sitting here talking about Kirk Cousins just got the first guaranteed contract in league history for a quarterback. And by the way, I don't even know any other position players talking about a multi-year deal, not like a one-year. Hey,
right.
We'll sign you to a one-year $12 million guaranteed deal. You get $12 million. No. 3 years, $84 million, all guaranteed. For a guy who has three straight 4,000-plus yard seasons, you think, oh, well, that's pretty good. Drew Brees has had 12 straight years of 4,000 or more. Five of them are 5,000 or more. Just in case you're wondering.
Here, by the way, quickly to put this into a different perspective, in his 12 seasons in New Orleans, so we're eliminating his first 4 years when he was with the Chargers.
Yeah.
Last season, 43-34. That's his lowest passing yard total as a member of the Saints. 23 touchdown passes, lowest as a member of the Saints. That's just crazy right there.
So his career has been arguably statistically as good as anybody's. I won't say better because of some of Manning's career numbers, et cetera, but as good just about as anybody's. My point to that is if any quarterback was going to deserve a guaranteed contract, I think Drew Brees, his two-year $50 million contract, would be the one. Talk about having earned it. Even if he tears a rotator cuff at in training camp or in preseason, Jim, and can't play these 2 years, it's like, hey Drew, here's the $50 million anyway, guaranteed just for past performance, for being the face and the model of a franchise for over a decade. You know, it's just what's due you. Aside from the fact that he probably will play both years because he's also got a great history of being healthy. He isn't maybe not to the level of LeBron James. And what's ironic is it wasn't he was thought perhaps by San Diego that he wouldn't be healthy enough to continue on when they decided to throw their lot in 2003 with Philip Rivers.
Right.
And let Drew Brees go. They thought Drew Brees would not be able to stay healthy. Well, all he's done is pretty much just go nonstop, cranking out 5,000 yard
seasons. I'm looking at his games played, and I see a bunch of 16s, 215. Okay, here's his lowest games played as a starter, 11, with the 0-3 Chargers.
Okay, so you're underscoring my point for me. If anybody deserved a guaranteed 2 year contract, because you can pretty much be guaranteed he'll be on the field.
Yeah.
For somewhere between 11 and 16 of them, probably all 16 of them, because he's too smart to take hits the way a lot of quarterbacks do. It would be Drew Brees. And looking at his contract, the Saints rewarded the best player in franchise history with a 50-year contract. Only $27 million of which is guaranteed. Just over half is guaranteed. So if he does blow out a knee or his shoulder or have his collarbone broken the way Aaron Rodgers did or something.
Or the fact that he'll be 39 this season starts rearing its ugly head.
Or if he falls off the proverbial cliff and can't complete passes at the level he used to, and I think that's what you mean by the age.
Yeah.
They don't have to pay him the other $23 million. Only $27 million is guaranteed. And that's why I have a problem with this Cousins thing. And I'm not sitting here trying, Kirk Cousins didn't do something to me or my family, okay? I'm not trying to bash him for personal reasons in any way. And Michigan State fans, if you want to tell me to shut up because he's Sparty and you're happy to see this for one of your guys, that's fine. But they just gave Kirk Cousins, who has never won a playoff game, $84 million guaranteed dollars at the age of 29. Or no, I'm sorry, is he 29 or 30? I was talking about that before. He is at 29, yeah. He'll be 30 before the season starts, though. He turns 30 August 19th. They just gave him $84 million guaranteed for having three seasons of 4,000-plus yards, not winning a playoff game. Talking about Minnesota doing this. And Drew Brees, who has essentially, and will when he's done after these 2 years, probably have almost every meaningful record that Peyton Manning ever set and broke, on his way to a first-ballot Hall of Fame career, can't even get a guaranteed two-year contract. That's an amazing thing to me. And I'll say this, chances are pretty good that the Saints struck this deal with Drew Brees before the Redskins, or excuse me, the Vikings announced this deal of $84 million guaranteed per Adam Schefter with Kirk Cousins. Because if he had, if Cousins had gone first, chances are Brees and his agent would have said, you know, can we like guarantee this? And I'm not saying Brees would have been Mr. Hardball guy and threatened to sit out if he didn't get it, but it would have been something to at least ask for. And now, as I said in the first half hour of the show, how many other players are going to ask for this, including the first pick of the draft coming up with the Browns? You don't think Sam Darnold's agent is going to say, you know, this is the new thing now. Kirk Cousins just got $84 million guaranteed. We want to follow that model, not the Drew Brees got only 27 out of 50 guaranteed. We want to follow that model. Agents are going to start playing hardball for their clients now, and you know damn well this is going to be something that the NFLPA, when the collective bargaining agreement is renegotiated in 2021, are going to insist on. They're going to insist, you know what, you can't take the violent nature of the game any longer and hold it against the players. You can't say, well, I can't guarantee him, you know, $75 million because he might get hurt. Well, you know what, a baseball player might take a fastball to the jaw and never play again either. Or he might blow out his elbow. Or a basketball player might, you know, land on the back of his head and break his neck the way Jaylen Brown almost did. Wasn't it Jaylen Brown? Landed with the Celtics. I think it was about three.
Jeez, now I'm trying to remember.
You didn't even see that, did you?
No.
You didn't see it. My God, Kush, you got to see it. Oh, my God. It's one of the most terrible things you've ever seen. Fast break dunk, went up with two hands and dunked it. His body's momentum carried him, like, you know, swinging like a pendulum from the rim, you know, toward the baseline, and he lost his grip on the rim and came crashing down on the back of his head and neck. I thought he broke his neck. I thought it was going to be a death on the freaking court. It was that bad. Anyway.
Now you're going to make me want to look this up.
We'll do it later. But the point is, you know, hey, that could happen, and that money's guaranteed. So the NFL, this is, like I said, this is a landmark moment, and if they want to have a landmark moment, that's fine. I just don't like it when it's non-landmark players. You know, if somebody is going to be the new poster child of NFL free agency contracts or even draft contracts negotiated with draft picks, it ought to be, you know, the best among us and not Kirk Cousins, who now, to me, makes me wish at Matthew Stafford or Jimmy Garoppolo. Well, not Garoppolo. No, I mean, because, you know, again, I try to be consistent. As you know, people might not like it, but I'm always consistent in my arguments. I didn't like Matthew Stafford being the highest paid player in the history of the National Football League because he hadn't earned it. He's a franchise quarterback, yes, and teams want to hold on to the franchise quarterback, so they got to pony up what they got to pony up. I get it, but he has, you know, he's not the best player in the history of the league, let alone, you know, the current best player in the league, so why does he get the most money ever? But that was short term, his status as the highest paid player, because Garoppolo passed him, did he not? Garoppolo passed him with what the Niners are going to pay him in a long term extension. And Garoppolo has started what? 7 games in the NFL?
Yep.
So, ironically, as I sit here and complain about Kirk Cousins being the new highest paid per player or per season player with the most guaranteed money in history, I'd rather have it be him than Garoppolo. You know, I'm sitting here ripping Cousins. He's only done this for 3 years and he's never won a playoff game. Well, Garoppolo's only started 7 games in his entire career. He doesn't even have the resume that Cousins does. And Cousins doesn't have the resume that Stafford does. And guess what? Stafford doesn't have the resume that Aaron Rodgers, Ben Roethlisberger, Tom Brady, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, have. Talking about Russell Wilson, talking about Super Bowl champion quarterbacks who are still statistical beasts in their careers, whether they be in the prime of their career or at the, you know, tail end of the prime of their career or in the latter stages of the career, like, for example, in Brady and Brees' case. But to me, if anybody is going to set those records, it ought to be those guys. Kirk Cousins, get a middle-of-the-road contract because you are a middle-of-the-road quarterback. You're not top shelf. You're, you know, if this is alcohol, and I don't drink, so I got to try to do this just by memory. It's what? The top shelf, is it called top shelf? And then there's, like, well drinks?
Yeah.
And then there's, I don't drink, damn it, bad analogy by my part, I'm sorry. But it's like top shelf and then well and then I don't know what the next level down is. You know, you're not on the top shelf, Kirk Cousins. To me, you're probably not on the well shelf. You're ascending to that from whatever the third shelf down is in terms of price. Okay? You're climbing the wall.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? You're trying to get to that shelf. That's where I am with Kirk Cousins, and therefore he should not be making top shelf money more than anybody else ever has in the history of the league. And I'm going to go back on one other thing, too. One other thing on Case Keenum situation. Case Keenum had a better statistical season for a team that went farther than Kirk Cousins did with his team. He won in the playoffs, did not get it done against Philadelphia in what was an all-time game for the Eagles in the NFC Championship game, which propelled them into the Super Bowl, where they damn near, they did beat the Patriots, but they damn near threw a knockout blow at the Patriots. Turned out to be a tremendous comeback opportunity for the Patriots. They played a damn near perfect game in winning the championship, and that's the team that knocked Case Keenum out. Case Keenum is going to make $10 to $12 million less in his deal with the Broncos. We have not seen those final figures. At least I haven't seen those final figures come in. If I'm the Cleveland Browns, if I'm the, and I'm trying to think of teams, the New York Jets, if I'm the Denver Broncos who are doing this, they teams who are in need of a quarterback, I would much rather pay $16 to $18 million for a Case Keenum than I would $28 million, all of which are guaranteed per year for 3 years, for a Kirk Cousins. I absolutely would. You can solve your quarterback dilemma without overpaying for mediocre players. I would rather pay a market price, which is what Keenum will get based on his performance last year mostly, and the hope that he's not a, kind of a one-year wonder kind of a thing. The hope that this was not an aberration or an anomaly, an outlier, that this is what he can be for the next few years. He's only 1 year older than Cousins. I would rather pay 16 to 18 for him than 28 for Kirk Cousins. And I think, and I hope, I shouldn't say that. That would have been evil. That would have been mean. I was going to say, I hope the Vikings come to regret this. But I don't wish bad things on Kirk Cousins. I just want sensible spending from football teams, because it's eventually going to trickle down to your team. Those benchmarks that are set by guys like that are going to trickle down to the Lions. They're going to trickle down to the Browns with their quarterback, whoever they end up getting after Tyrod Taylor. All of these things are going to trickle down. It's going to impact the Steelers, as I mentioned, probably not with a quarterback, but with Le'Veon Bell because of the guaranteed money and, the essentially the new norm, if you will, is what it could be for NFL contracts. Okay, had to get all of that out there. I'll tell you what, we're going to get a timeout now. We have a bottom-of-the-hour Sports Center, local Sports Center coming your way. Then we're going to talk basketball, college style, but not talking about the NCAA tournament. We'll talk about just barely missing the NCAA tournament, and that means the Toledo Rockets, who lost the MAC championship game to Buffalo on Saturday, playing without Conference Player of the Year Treshawn Fletcher. Coach Todd Kowalczyk will talk about the season, talk about that run, talk about how close it came, and talk about how to fix things so that teams like the Rockets that have really, really outstanding years in mid-major conferences but come up just short in the playoff or in the tournament still have an opportunity to play postseason basketball. So Coach Kowalczyk joins us next right here. Stay with us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well, I tell you what, I wish I had as much pull with Jim Kirschlin as Todd Kowalczyk does. Kowalczyk comes in here 2-3 weeks ago, says, "Hey, Kirschlin, how about a little super tramp when you bring me on?" And Kirschlin just dutifully obeys. I mean, just jerk that leash and here comes Kush. I don't know how you get that kind of cachet, Coach Kowalczyk, but let me know what you did so that I can see if I can get some work out of the guy that's the same way.
Just got to be nice to him, Bob. That's it.
Well, then, hell, I'm screwed. I'm never nice to the guy. Coach, welcome back. Good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. I appreciate, being on the entire season, and I really, truly enjoy it.
Well, we enjoy having you. It's really... I'm going to say this not to be butt-kissy, but you know what coach speak is. And we talk to a lot of guys. I've talked to a lot of guys in 20 years on the radio, coaches that give me coach speak and just give me, standard answers and try to avoid saying anything, remotely personal or informational. And you're not that way. And I really, really enjoy the conversations, whether we're talking basketball philosophy, X's and O's, your players, losses or wins or whatever. You give actual real, real responses, and that makes this off a lot of fun. So thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. I sometimes my honesty gets me in trouble, though. I got to be honest with you.
Well, if you do anything, that's trouble-worthy here, we'll make sure to delete the tape so nobody can.
All right. Okay. All right.
And you haven't done it yet, by the way. All right. Hey, Coach. Obviously, we'll talk about. I want to do a season wrap with you and a season recap and look back at highs and lows and accomplishments and look forward, of course, to building on this very successful season in a moment, but. Obviously, we are all disappointed that there is no postseason basketball for the Rockets. Clearly, You know, the one-bid league situation, you know, rears its ugly head here. Buffalo goes in. They got a very tough draw, by the way, as a 13 seed out there going to face Arizona. And okay. But we talked about this with you before. No, not even an NIT opportunity here for the second-place team in the conference, team that lost the conference championship game, especially considering the circumstances under which you did lose the conference championship in the tournament, you know, playing without the conference player of the year in the semis, getting a win there, and then just coming up short in the finals. You would think that somebody would say, I want to see that team play postseason basketball, and it's very frustrating that you're not. How do you deal with that?
I think... reality, you know, I'm in the Mid-American Conference as a head basketball coach. This is not a high major league. It's a one bid league, and for the most part, always has been. And unfortunately, right now, how the NIT works, it's extremely difficult for mid majors to get in. And I don't know if we've really talked about the NIT process, but roughly 10 years ago, the NCAA tournament bought. Or the NCAA, not the NCAA, the NCAA bought the men's NIT. The women's NIT is still, you know, a private, you know, company. And basically they shrunk it from 48 teams to 32 teams. And what they did also, the NCAA, was make anybody that's a number one seed in their conference tournament that got upset in the conference tournament, they have an automatic bid to the NIT. Well, there was, in the bottom leagues, you know, we're the 10th ranked league out of 32. In the bottom 15 leagues, there was 13 upsets, which is, you know, a little bit strange, but that's what happened. So there was 13 automatic bids, which only left 19 at large bids. And those at large bids, they need to have Power 5 teams and, you know, bigger conferences to, you know, kind of provide some, you know, great crowds, and certainly, you know, how they make money off this is getting the right teams to go to New York. So that's, I anticipated it.
Yeah, I know you did. You and Jim talked about it 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, yeah. I don't remember, but you kind of expected that would be the case, and because of your knowledge of it. It was better then before the NCAA bought the NIT. It should be a separate entity, at least in theory, in order for it to, you know, for the NCAA not to have that kind of pull on with the power conferences.
Yeah, and I think everybody thought, you know, for the mid majors and low major, you know, programs, that automatic bid is a good thing, and it is, but it's not for the American Conference or Toledo. Our league is too good now. We're tenth, you know. So, you know, it's good if. You know, the number one seed in our conference is like Buffalo, no matter what, was going to go to the NIT had we beaten them. You know, they didn't need the automatic bid. They would have, you know, they had a 25, you know, RPI. They were in no matter what, but we had a 75 RPI. That would tell you, you know, with 68 teams in the NCAA and 32 in the NIT, you deserve to go. But
absolutely.
It doesn't work that way. I mean, and there was five or six teams that had RPIs well below us, that get in the NIT. And one of them was my best friend. He's the head coach at Boston College, Jim Christian, had a 96 RPI. Well, he knew, you know, a week or two ago that he was going to get the NIT. They knew.
We're talking to Coach Todd Kowalczyk about postseason basketball, NIT and NCAA style, and obviously there's nothing you can really do. The old adage of not being able to fight City Hall. City Hall has no power compared to the NCAA or that selection committee, and obviously the NIT committee as well. So let's talk about what we can talk about, and that is that that MAC tournament. What a tremendous run getting to the final. You hoped you could get there. The top two teams in the conference all season long have been Buffalo and Toledo. You do get there, but obviously you get there minus the conference player of the year. First, in fact, since we kind of, our little pattern has been to talk about the last two games anyway all week, all season long, when we talk to each week, it works out perfectly here. We'll talk about the semi-conference win over Eastern and then that conference championship game loss to Buffalo. First of all, tremendous job of coming back against a team that had beaten you twice in the previous, what, week and a half in the regular season. That's an amazing thing. And then to do it, as we mentioned, without Treshawn, who obviously was injured very late in the quarterfinal game, tell us how you were able to pull that off against Eastern.
Well, the first two games were very close. That, you know, in the game at Eastern Michigan, you know, they went on an 8-0 run with about, you know, between 8 and, you know, 5 minutes left in the game and got a little bit of a cushion. we were up, and then you know you're down five. That was the difference. It was clearly we had some ill-advised shots and some turnovers that led to transition, and that's how they went on that run. You know, and I thought we really corrected it when we played them here. I thought, you know, we're up, you know, when we played them at our place, we didn't have a very good start. But for 30 minutes of that game, we played really good. And then it came down to the last minute of the game where we had, you know, four plays really go against us. Two really bad turnovers. Morion and Trayshawn had really bad turnovers. And then with a minute to play, we're up two. You know, Morion had a unbelievably bad call by a referee that should, you know, it was just a bad call, which I really think cost us the game. Had we gotten that stop, we could have scored and been up four with 50 seconds or less to play. You know, and at that point, you know, game over, or should be game over. Mm-hmm. But they were close games, and our game against in the conference tournament was close as well. You know, we had a, you know, I thought we played really well without Trey because he is as good or maybe even the best zone offensive player I've ever coached. You get him the ball in the high post, he's a passer. He's a playmaker. He's a scorer. You know, and that's what you need to do against that 2-3 zone is get the ball to the high post. If you can't get the ball to the high post and have a playmaker up there, you know, you're not going to beat that zone. You're just not. You can shoot all the threes you want, but you got to get the ball to the high post. And, you know, I thought our guys did a really good job.
Let's talk about Marion, Jackson, because, you know, a freshman, 8 points a game on the season, very good contribution as a freshman, no doubt about that. To bust out and have a school record 8 threes in a conference semifinal game against a team like that, a zone team, and, you know, known for that. Talk about zone busting. He did exactly that. And then, of course, the game winner, what turned out to be the game winner with 9 seconds left. What an amazing step up for him.
Unbelievable. But I'm not surprised. I thought that the shot before that was 40 seconds to play with 1 second on the shot clock. It was almost, I don't want to say it was luck, but it was not a very good shot. He forced it, but with 1 second he had to. And it goes in. The last shot, I thought, was a good left-right rhythm fundamental shot that he should have taken and should have made.
Yeah, well, you know, it was really an amazing thing to see somebody step up and pick up the scoring slack created by the loss of Trayshawn. But obviously that was a little too much to overcome in the final against Buffalo. And, you know, to take nothing against away from Buffalo, I'm not suggesting, I was talking about this yesterday, I'm not suggesting that, you know, if Trayshawn is there, it's an automatic win. You know, does he mean 10 points to this team? Is it a 10-point margin? Does he mean 10 points would switch and give you the championship? Maybe, but nothing guaranteed. Buffalo's a very good basketball team and a very good season. But can you talk about the challenge of facing, you know, what turned out to be the best team in the conference without the conference's best player?
Yeah, and I'd like to think, well, it was a closer than a 10-point game. The entire way, it was never double digits. He was always, you know, within 4, 5, 6 points, a lot of 2 points. We were up a couple times. We tied at 60-60 with 6 minutes to play. You know, it was, you know, I'd like to think, and that's just, you know, my opinion, if we have Trey, it's a different outcome, but that's just me saying that, and I'm biased, obviously, but
well, you might be there. That's kind of how I looked at it. I said, I mean, I can't say no, his presence would not have won you the championship, but I can't say definitively it would have either because, you know, everything changes when you have him there. You know, your offense changes, what other guys are asked to do changes. So you just don't know. But, yeah, it very well could have. You know, he certainly scores more than 10 points a game if you just look at it from a simplistic standpoint.
Well, I first of all, they're very good. I felt even after we played them the first time, they were deeper. They were a little more athletic, maybe a little more talented. You know, quite a bit more athletic, but, you know, maybe a little more talented. I just thought we were had a little better skill and a little better discipline. And I thought we, because of that, we could be a better team. And it turns out we weren't because they won 15 conference games. We won 13, and they beat us twice. And give them credit. And I hope they, you know, really bad draw, which I'm unbelievably disappointed with. As being a 13 seed, I do wish, you know, them well in the tournament, and hopefully they can represent our league and get a win.
Coach, put 2017/18 into perspective. What did you accomplish for the program this year? And if you want to go ahead and tie that into the next question, is how does that set you up for future success in 18-19?
I just feel really good about the future and where we're at culture wise. And you and I both know last year we won 17 games. Everybody knows all about all the you know, the overtime games, all that. But it was a disappointment, and a disappointment because I thought we had selfishness. I just don't think we played as a team, for the duration of the season. This year's team was an unbelievable team. They were unselfish. They were together. The chemistry was fantastic. The leadership was fantastic. We didn't have a bad practice. We had one bad game at home against Ball State. The rest of the games, we competed. We were had legitimate chances to win every one of them, excluding the Kansas game. I loved coaching this team. I had so much fun. Well, last year, to be honest, I didn't have fun. You know, that's the difference. And next year's team will be the same way because we have the same guys except for Trayshawn. Our leadership will be really good. But, you know, when you take one guy off, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. And I learned a valuable lesson in 14-15. We had a lot of guys back from a 27-win team. You know, I don't know if I was necessarily hard enough on guys like Juice Brown and Justin Drummond in their senior year. And I promised our seniors next year that's not going to be the case. I'm going to be hard on them. I'm going to be demanding, and I'm going to, you know, hold them accountable, to make sure that all the little things are done.
Coach, when you said last year's team was selfish and this year's was not, they were more of a team, what changed? Was it the leaders? Did you do anything different to foster a different kind of atmosphere or environment for them, or did they take it upon themselves? Is it, you know, the loss of some players, you know, addition by subtraction? What changed?
I think personnel. I mean, I do think we had some really unselfish guys, too. I mean, that doesn't mean everybody was selfish, but,
sure.
You know, the old cliche, it just, you know, it takes one guy to lose, everybody to win. You know, there's a lot of truth to that. Sometimes you take one guy off of the team or two guys off of a team, and it's a dramatic change. Now, with that being said, you know, Jordan Rolfe was a great leader, tremendous leader, but a different type of leader. He did it by his toughness. By playing hurt, by, you know, doing all the little things, but not necessarily the vocal part. That wasn't his personality, which is, hey, I've grown to appreciate all kinds of leaders, and not everybody's vocal, where Trayshawn was really a vocal leader. And that certainly changed a little bit the leadership. But when your best player is your best facilitator and passer and your hardest worker and the guys in the gym the most, That changes the dynamics, and so that's the reason why.
Coach Todd Kowalczyk, UT Rockets head coach, joining us for a little retrospective on the Rocket season. I've got one more for you, and then Jim Cushion wants to maybe ask the last question of the day. What does Trayshawn Fletcher's future hold? How do you see him? And I know you're not an NBA scout, but can he play at the next level? Is he going to play professionally somewhere, or what do you think?
He is going to play professionally somewhere, and I think he'll have a chance to have a career out of it. Some guys can go over there and have an experience. There's a big difference between having an experience in Europe or in the NBA and having a career. He's good enough to have a career. Where it is and what league, I don't know. I do know this. He's unbelievably versatile. They love the fact that at his size, at 6'7", he can handle it and pass it. You can't speed him up. He can shoot it. He can guard his position, which is important. Unfortunately he got hurt, I really don't want to get into any specifics there, but, it's a pretty significant injury and he's going to be out a while.
Oh, well, that's something I did not want to know, to be honest with you. I was hoping it was something that would be relatively easy to bounce back, not in time to come back for the tournament, obviously, but to come back from. Period. Jim Cushion, got one for you. Jimmy?
Yeah, thinking about a little bit going into next season, I know whether I'm talking on the football angle, the coaches, or the basketball angle, it is a 24/7 job. You don't have to name names or anything like that, but what type of players will you be targeting and recruiting this offseason?
Well, we do have two verbal commitments right now, and you can go online and look those up. I can't say anything about them or who they are, but yeah, you know, obviously we're on the radio, but if you could see my smile, you'd know how I feel. Let's put it that way.
Well, that is
good. I said that pretty legally, didn't I?
Yeah, yes, you did. Yes, you did. See, you said your honesty gets you in trouble, but you know how to make sure that you don't get into trouble. But Well, listen, Coach, a really tremendous season, 13-5, first place in the MAC West, 23-11 overall, just a hair away from advancing to the NCAA tournament with a conference championship game loss. Coach, it's been a pleasure, really a lot of fun talking to you all season long, and I can't wait for 2018-19 to begin so we can do it again.
Hey, everybody's back but Trayshawn. We got some nice pieces that'll be here as well. So it'll be a fun year again for the Rockets.
No question about it. Thank you, Coach.
Thanks, guys.
Coach Todd Kowalczyk for the final time in this season. We ought to just have him on once a month just to talk, just for the hell of it. We can talk pro football with that guy, and I think it would be enjoyable radio, Jim, because
Coach Kowalczyk. I happen to agree with that completely.
I mean, really, it's just fun. I mean, just to talk sports with him. Some guys just have it, and he does, his personality. Okay, that's it. Speaking of personality, Mike Miller's got one, too, and Drive Time is coming up next right here on the ticket. Stay here for that. Tomorrow, we're back again for the next extravaganza at 3 o'clock. Free agency frenzy. The league year starts when our show starts at 3 o'clock sharp tomorrow. We'll be all over it, talking about with representatives from the Lions, talking about people from Cleveland, talking about it with people from Cleveland as well. All of that will be on.